And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fighting that heat. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died for me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com or AltRightTV.com. This is an interesting write-up that appeared last weekend in the National Post by Conrad Black. Conrad Black is a well-informed columnist, author, former publisher of the Spectator in England, the Times of London, the Chicago Tribune, and eventually all this was taken away from him. Here's some of his thoughts on some of what's been happening with the coronavirus situation in Canada. The Canadian government's management of the coronavirus crisis, if judged by what it does and its leaders say, is completely inadequate. Their relief bill is probably not sufficient in quantum or efficiency for those unemployed or underemployed as a result of the public health crisis. And they're now saying the economy could be essentially shut down through June. Now, it may not come to that, but anyway, the closing of the U.S. border is nonsensical. And if the U.S. Army is moved to deploy significant numbers of its personnel to the border, as was briefly suggested last week, it will be demoralizing as well as an absurd event. The last time we had armed, uniformed people on that border was when Georges-Étienne Cartier, as Canada's first Minister of Defense and Militia, placed the formidable force of 50,000 along the Quebec and New Brunswick borders with the United States. I think 50,000 when our population was probably 6 million. Now, that's a considerable army. That's just a little less than the size of our army today when we have a population of about 38 million. Just to put that in perspective. Militia was also placed near the Thousand Islands, near Kingston, Ontario, and Niagara Falls, and around Windsor. And this was in 1870 to deter the Fenians. These were Irish-American malcontents who wished to repay the British crown for the Irish famine of the late 1840s by seizing Canada. At least there was a legitimate reason for having armed force at the border. There has been none for the past, in the intervening 150 years. Even more regrettable was the brief effort of the federal government to have a stump parliament reduced almost 80% in numbers, approve the allocation of unlimited powers for the government to tax, borrow, and spend in any manner and amount the cabinet might choose, with no recourse to parliament until the end of 2021. That was the proposal, and that that extension of the date beyond what might be reasonable, let's say 90 days to what was essentially going to be 18 months, was snuck in at the last minute. Now that was fortunately beaten to a standstill. This was apparently more an act of panic than of usurpation, but was no less an outrage for that. Now here's again some perspective. When Winston Churchill was invested with practically absolute powers by King George VI on May 10, 1940, as Prime Minister of a government of national unity. Now this is Canada does not have a government of national unity. It's actually a liberal minority government. So basically to castrate the opposition for over half of the parliamentary session is an outrage, and which fortunately did not go through. But just by way of perspective, Churchill, of course, was then facing a world war, which was now almost at the English Channel, and overhead and in the sea lanes. Britain was in a declared state of unlimited emergency, and all legislative authorities was delegated to the War Cabinet by both Houses of Parliament. That's the House of Parliament, Commons and the House of Lords. For the regime in Ottawa to ask for even greater and more arbitrary authority to deal with a nasty virus shows both the mediocrity of knowledge and the judgment of the senior political civil servants and a painful and disquieting lack of any constitutional perspective or sense of proportion by the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's Minister of Finance. The fact that the proposed measure was hastily withdrawn after opposition objections, especially by Conservative leader Andrew Scheer, doesn't offer much consolation. The hero of Parliament was the Conservative backbencher Scott Reed, who crashed the session and tweeted purposefully. Now, Reed was actually not even supposed to be there, because the each caucus designated certain people that would represent them in proportion. But when Reed read what was in the legislation, he didn't think his colleagues were up to speed on this, that they got it, which is terrifying. But terrifying, but helps clarify things. Well, one of the things I have long pondered is how in the British Parliament, successively, freedoms, especially free speech, have been eroded in the past 50 years. And similarly in Canada. Now, to their credit, the Conservatives did fight the hate bill in 1971. But there's never been an effort to repeal it. In fact, the first person, elected person, to call for its repeal was Maxime Bernier, who was then no longer a Conservative last year, as he headed the People's Party of Canada. But it shows the mediocrity or complicity, choose your interpretation, of many members of Parliament. They're just not very bright and don't know very much about history. That's one thing about Conrad Black. He knows a lot about history. Anyway, Scott Reed, really the hero of the moment, tweeted purposefully, his confusion of Henry VIII with Charles I was more than compensated for by his stirring invocation of William F. Buckley standing athwart history and shouting stop. Sometimes, in fact, that sometimes is the role of the conservative, is to shout during moments of crowd enthusiasm, or in this case, well, less crowd enthusiasm than just skullduggery. Stop. When a friend telephoned me of this astounding initiative, I took the unusual step of watching the CBC to see how the public broadcaster played it. My stupefaction was considerable when this illegal and autocratic proposal was not referred to at all. Whatever its shortcomings, the CBC can usually be relied upon to take any Canadian government to task for completely preposterous acts. The apparent silence could not possibly have been censorship, although totalitarian fiscal powers had been let through. Censorship of the media would be the logical sequel. Nor could it have been exaggerated deference to authority. It had to be simple indifference. The opinion of the National Broadcasting senior news editors that this scandalous development was unworthy of comment. And that is a point that people have commented on, referenced Canada's great free speech warrior of the 80s, 90s, and the first decade of this century, Doug Christie. And Doug Christie said not to look to constitutions or bills of rights or charters of rights and freedoms for what freedoms you have. He said you only have the freedoms you're prepared to fight for, or maybe put a different way, that you're prepared to exercise. And if you no longer care about freedom, freedoms, it little matters what's written down in the law. If substantial elements in the society no longer care, those freedoms will not be there. There will always be somebody who, for an allegedly good cause, will want to take them from you. And perhaps this is just another way of echoing the very valid observation that eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. That we've got to watch out in every generation. There will come a people, a force, a movement, circumstances, which will want to limit freedoms. Sometimes for an ostensibly good purpose. Sometimes, hey, we've got the power, we'll do what we want. It little matters. Every generation must be on the alert, or you lose the freedoms. As Britain, it is pathetic, the freedoms that they have lost since the end of the empire. Not only have they been invaded with the active connivance of the political class. In terms of the Third World invasion of Britain and the fact that Britain, that London, the heart of the English-speaking world from so many centuries, the heart of the British Empire, is now essentially a non-white city. That all came about not because Britain lost some sort of war and the enemy flooded in. Well, yeah, actually they did lose the war. They lost World War II. Well, they thought they won it, but they actually lost it. But that's another story. But the people that are storming in, they're not the ones who beat Britain. The loss of rights occurs when enough people just don't give a flip. This is Conrad, back to Conrad Black. I wrote that the government's management of the coronavirus appears incompetent, and it does, except for the fact that the crisis shows no sign of remotely approaching a scale that justifies the emergency measures that are being taken. At the time of this writing, in a country of 38 million people, we have 37 deaths from about 3,800 identified cases. I think we're now up to about 8,000, and that's 8,000 cases and about 100 deaths. The public health system is insufficiently sophisticated that if there were significantly more fatalities from these cases, they would have been identified even if our testing capacity is inadequate, to be confident that there is not a larger number of infected people. And that's quite true. Of advanced countries with reliable statistics, only Germany has a lower percentage of fatalities among reported cases, about half of 1%. And the United States, which in medical terms is demographically similar to Canada and leads the world in testing, of about 500,000 people by late last Thursday, it comes third with about 1.4% of cases resulting in fatalities. And as I mentioned before, to have valid valid death rate, you have to have valid testing. If very few, or relatively few people have been tested, and you have, let's say, only 100 people being tested, and you have five deaths, and you have a death rate of 5%. But if in fact, there were 500 people who had the virus, and if you had better testing, and you know, five people died of 500 people who had the virus, well, then you have a death rate of 1%. If Germany, Canada, and the United States are the leaders in limiting mortal coronavirus cases, the Netherlands and the United States are the hero nations of public policy. The Dutch have refused to be spooked and have not seriously tried to reduce travel or rights of assembly or attendance at schools and workplaces. Though they are trying to protect the elderly, and it's the elderly who would appear to be the most vulnerable. They're not the only ones who die, but in a small retirement home or home to care for the aged up in Bob Cage in Ontario, with only about 70 patients there, the death toll is now up to 14 plus one member of staff. And there's a retirement home called Oak Ridges in Scarborough, Ontario. We're not informed how many patients are there, but seven have died. It seemed the old are very vulnerable. Yet their fatality, that's in Holland, percentages are almost exactly the same as France's, which is on lockdown imposed by armed forces. The Dutch are reporting only 1% more fatalities over confirmed cases than the UK, and 2% less than Spain, and 4.5% less than Italy. So, you know, there's some reason to question the lockdown or increasing lockdown, and apparently we're going to get more of that in Canada in the next few days. The Imperial College of Medicine in London, England, projections were that were so widely circulated a few weeks ago of 500,000 deaths in Great Britain and 2.2 million in the US are being revised downwards by over 95%. That's not actually being reported that much, that the you know, worst case scenarios, based probably on more on speculation than on data, have been scaled back. Even that reduced level of expected fatalities is surely an exaggeration. There is a case to be made for draconian measures to reduce the overall number of infections and deaths, but putting the entire economy in abeyance rather than focusing on the vulnerable may cause more harm than good, writes Conrad Black. America's status as a hero pandemical nation rests on the administration's brilliant relief package, which will actually make this crisis a profitable experience for most of those economically affected by it. Conrad Black also goes on to say, if this pandemic was anything like as dire a threat as it had been claimed to be, the Canadian government's handling of it would have been an unmitigated fiasco. Rather, more than 25,000 people have died from it in the world. And that's a great tragedy. But China, the country of origin, despite grossly bungling the first 2 months of the illness, and not believable in its official accounts of events, appears to have largely through it. The world succumbed to a pandemic of hysteria, more than a virus, and it is time to follow the American, if not the Dutch, lead, starting with bringing back the elementary schools. Information from every study thus far shows that children seem largely immune to the virus, so the dangers to them are minimal. And although children can be carriers, strict social distancing measures in the classrooms, such as those in place in Taiwan, can allow classes to resume relatively unhindered. Now, this is a point of view that is not widely expressed in Canada or on CNN. Now, a very interesting situation with Israel and these Hasidic Jews, and there's also a connection here with Canada. The problem with the ultra-Orthodox Jews is a problem actually of Judaism. Judaism teaches that Jews are a special people. I should say the chosen people, not just special, but chosen. And in their conduct with Christian Gentile society, and increasingly as their power has grown, Jews have insisted on being special. For instance, on the right to wear their kippah or yarmulke or skull cap, even where headdress is not considered proper. On the right to try to dampen Christmas as a celebration, because traditionally Christians, Jews, don't particularly like the Lord Jesus Christ, which of course is their religious right, but there's been an attack on Christianity. Or the insistence that the Jewish relatively unimportant feast of Hanukkah be granted equal place with Christmas, which is a bit pushy considering Jews in Canada constitute less than 1% of the population, in the United States about 2% of the population. So Jews have increasingly wanted to be catered to as something special. Well, it's not much different in Israel. There's quite a tension between the ultra-Orthodox Jews and the more secular mainstream Jews. The ultra-Orthodox, for instance, most of the men insist on being exempt from military service, and basically, in many cases, don't work. They spend all their time studying and debating the Talmud and the Torah. Well, that makes them kind of a parasitical drain on Israeli society, and in a society of high taxation, there's widespread resentment of that. Also widespread resentment of the fact that because of their ultra-Orthodox beliefs, they don't want to serve in the armed forces, which creates some tension with their secular fellow citizens who have to serve in the armed forces. But that's part of the problem with being special. Well, now along comes many of them the men don't work, not in all cases, but in many cases they don't work, and the women have large families, so they're a double burden on Israeli society. Now comes the coronavirus case, and they simply don't want to follow the rules that apply to other Israelis limiting social contact, social distancing, and of avoiding large meetings. Well, here's a story from today's National Post. Israeli police are cracking down on ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods around the country that have emerged as coronavirus hotspots. As residents continue to ignore stay-at-home orders and bans on gatherings meant to stem the epidemic. And I suspect, although not stated in the article, there is the fact that many of these people are not particularly big on cleanliness. And one of the techniques urged on us to stem the spread of the coronavirus is frequent hand washing and sanitizing as best we can things in places in the house or in cars that we touch a lot. So using a an antibacterial wipe or even rubbing alcohol on a cloth to rub down your steering wheel, the handles on your door, the gear shift dials in the car that you touch, the emergency brake, the door to your house, the light switches on in the house. Well, if cleanliness is not a big part of your life, this all seems rather precious. And so, for a variety of reasons, the ultra-Orthodox communities are hotbeds of the coronavirus, which needless to say, lures the Israeli government. Back to the story, authorities have carried out raids on synagogues and deployed helicopters, which hover over streets filled with black-clad religious students, after these crowded insular communities recorded some of Israel's highest rates of infection. So they're not keeping their distance. As police have pushed into some of these neighborhoods, violence has broken out. Young ultra-Orthodox men threw rocks at police in Jerusalem's Mea Shearim neighborhood on Monday, after officers broke up a gathering at a synagogue and cited residents for straying more than 100 meters from their homes, which is a rule that other Israelis have to follow, with certain exceptions. 30 residents were fined up to $2,000 for violating health restrictions, and the army sent patrols into the neighborhood on Tuesday. Officials are now considering locking down an entire ultra-Orthodox entire ultra-Orthodox areas. You know, if they won't take requested measures to stop the spread, then they will have to be isolated. I'll be reading another story on that, but there's a connection with Canada, and this connection is that there's a ultra-Orthodox community near Montreal that is being basically surrounded so that people cannot get in or get out because there's a high rate of infection there. And it apparently came when a number of their community went down to some sort of ultra-Orthodox wedding, I believe. So the old game, and this is recently, this isn't. So, high concentration of people, some of whom are infected and maybe infected because of the less than sanitary practices in their community, and they brought the infection back to the ultra-Orthodox community near Montreal. Now, this woman is a Jewess, Vivian Berkovici. She was the former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and she now lives in Tel Aviv. And she has an interesting column about this same issue. On Saturday night, Israelis braced for an announcement of more restrictive lockdown measures, which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been threatening for days. And then they turned on the news and had a fun surprise, the broadcast of a leaked audio from a cabinet meeting several days earlier when the tougher measures were being discussed. In the tape, Netanyahu showed himself to be iron-fisted and brooking no dissent. After a brief tussle over whether to keep falafel stands open, he stated simply, "The answer is no. 5 falafel stands can collaborate to deliver." So instead of having these street stands where people can congregate, and they're not supposed to. The falafel, I guess you call them red dealers or restaurateurs, will basically sell take-up. The most rancorous exchange pitted sports versus synagogues, with the secular ministers advocating hard to allow outdoor sports to continue, while their ultra-Orthodox colleagues chafed, with one snapping, look at all the time you spend discussing sport, yet you decide to close the synagogues with the flick of a hand. Now, of course, the closures are because you've got people in packed quarters. And the whole strategy of social distancing is to spread people out, prevent close contact, especially in communities that are already heavily infected. The Prime Minister made quick business of that too, and this was in a tape of the meeting that was being leaked. Synagogues have been the largest sources of infection, together with clubs and shops, he continued. There is no choice. If you need someone to take responsibility, I will take that responsibility. And that was that. There's been a building anger among the majority of Israelis who have complied impressively with the ever-tighter restrictions imposed on mobility, while watching their ultra-Orthodox compatriots carry on as if there wasn't a pandemic. As if, and here's that psychology again, as if they're special or chosen not to have to obey the same rules that other people do. The anger surged on Sunday morning as two damning videos went viral on the internet. One showed a large funeral procession on Saturday night, clogging the streets of B'nai Brak, an almost exclusively ultra-Orthodox city of 200,000 people. That's an awful lot of people that are in a hotbed already. So the clip showed police standing around doing nothing as hundreds of male mourners followed the ambulance carrying the body of a prominent rabbi to his burial site. So in other words, a mass gathering. Exactly what had been banned. Police doing nothing. And that is often the complaint about police. On important things, they're inactive. On unimportant things, they're very active. Again, today I had to go down an expressway in my city of Hamilton called the Lincoln-Alexander Expressway, or locally just called the Link. As I went down, I would say maybe this 10-mile stretch. Once again, lurking in the median was a black and white Hamilton police car, looking to do some revenueing, catching speeders. And I thought, you know, at a time this pandemic, where last week a million Canadians lost their jobs. Now, we only have 38 million people. We don't have 38 million workers. You know, subtract stay-at-home moms, children too young to work, retired people, and young people too young to work. I think our national workforce would be not much more than half of that. 1 million people. And these people are hurting. Many of them in my own community. They've lost their job. That means no income. Well, no income until they can get unemployment insurance. In some cases, they won't be able to get it. But anyway, so no income. And to slap on additional suffering in the form of a fine is just gratuitous cruelty. And worse than that, just dumb policing. You know, you want to ask, well, are there no other, is there no crime going on in the city? Well, let me tell you, there's a lot of crime going on. Anyway, that's the dumb, That's Hamilton, but back to Israel. So the police are doing nothing with this ultra-Orthodox funeral procession. Simultaneously, though, a second video went viral showing a lone cyclist in Tel Aviv's main park being chased by two police cars. The biker got away, cheered on by the nation. He posed no threat to anyone, and the police machismo was so over the top, particularly compared with their non-enforcement of social distancing and other measures at the ultra-Orthodox funeral. This is dumb policing. And, once again, probably they went light, did nothing about the ultra-Orthodox because they portrayed themselves as special, a privileged group. Whereas the lone cyclist, who I'm not sure what rule he was violating, but certainly he wasn't posing any threat to anybody. He's lone, A crowd does pose a threat. Meanwhile, the notoriously irreverent and enterprising Israeli media got down to business, ferreting out information that had not been forthcoming from the public health authorities. On Sunday, there were multiple reports that more than half of all those infected with the virus in Israel were from the ultra-Orthodox communities, as were those hospitalized with serious symptoms. In light of this disclosure, clamping down further on the vast majority who were complying was pointless and would have seriously damaged the credibility of the government. And that's so often what governments do. They beat up on the law-abiding. Now, the ultra-Orthodox, if my memory serves, constitute perhaps 10% of the Israeli population. But they constitute, 10% of the population, constitute more than half of those seriously infected with the coronavirus, who are now clogging the Israeli hospitals. targeting elements of the ultra-Orthodox population where contagion and illness rates are alarmingly high is not construed as being bigoted in any way, but scientifically sound and eminently justifiable. And this is some of the opinions of Vivian Berkovici. She says that there is so much uncertainty as new data and knowledge emerge and clarify constantly. But on certain basic facts, there's general consensus in the scientific community. The COVID or coronavirus 19 is aggressive, highly contagious, transmitted by asymptomatic individuals, and must be contained physically and geographically to control it. It's interesting that she tries to slap down an accusation that we hear in its only a slightly other form in Canada. There are many examples globally of various governments and other interests exploiting the coronavirus threat to further ideological agendas. Yes, and I've touched on some of those, and we'll touch on that again. Among the more sinister is a tendency to tag as racist any preventative measures that target identifiable groups that may be particularly contagious. And she refutes the idea that the targeting the ultra-Orthodox in Israel is in any way discriminatory or racist. It's just common sense. And that's been my argument from the beginning about targeting, not exclusively, but targeting people from China, flights from China, because that was the original source of this pandemic, China. But as recently as practically yesterday, well, to be quite fair, the end of last week, we were still accepting, in fact, I think we still are accepting some flights from China. Canada's a major airline, Air Canada, is no longer flying to most Chinese cities. But immediately that it became obvious where that pandemic was, or in those days, epidemic, we should have been curtailing all travel from China and rigorously testing everybody who came off a plane from China. Well, you know, initially, until almost just yesterday, the response of the Canadian government, the trust fund kid, the prime minister, and the chief medical officer of health, this China woman, Theresa Tam, was to give us a good old finger-wagging lecture about racism and not targeting communities. And that's where it's great to use Jared Taylor's construction, about not debating, is it racist? No, it's race realism. Race is a factor. If it's in play here, to recognize that is just realism. It's not a matter of hating anybody or hating any group. It's a matter of being smart. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my bluegrass musical interlude right now. And once again, I want to thank Mark and Tina Palazzolo for sending this collation of great bluegrass tunes. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
Thank you. three cracks and just one dot, and that says, who you think I am, Black Hawk missing to buy one ham.
Hey, Bad Fanatic, oh, Bad Fanatic, hey, Bad Fanatic, you're the one for me.
Behind the bars,
hey, Bad Fanatic, oh, Bad Fanatic, hey, Bad Fanatic, you're the one for me.
Nanny put on her Sunday dress, thought that it would look the best, made out of an old feet sack, hot feet rope right on the back,
hey, Bad Fanatic, oh, Bad Fanatic.
Nelly's got a pair of shoes and she can wear them if she'll choose. So why the heck she got the blues when she wants to wear a size 22?
Hey, Bad Fanatic, oh, Bad Fanatic, hey, Bad Fanatic, you're the one for me.
Thank you. Grass is growing, water's flowing, a free and easy way. But give me a nut for the final stuff that's made near Galway Bay. Oh, peelers all from Donegal, Galway Leap from two. We'll give them the slip and we'll take a sip of the real long mountain dew. At the foot of the hill there's a neat little still where the smoke curls up to the sky. By the smoke and the smell you can plainly tell that there's quick cane brewing nearby. For it fills the air with odor rare and betwixt both me and you. When home you roll you can take a ball or a bucket of the mountain dew. Now learned men who use the pen wrote your praises high. This sweet poutine from Ireland's green, distilled from wheat and rye. Throw away your pills at the cure all ills of pagan or Christian dew. Take off your coat and free your throat with the real old mountain dew. Hi da diddly day da diddly day da diddly day da dum diddly dum day diddly day day. Ha da da diddly day da dum diddly dum day da dum diddly dum day diddly day day. Ha da diddly day da dum diddly dum day da dum diddly dum day diddly day day. Ha da da diddly day da dum diddly dum day da dum diddly dum day diddly day day. Thank you.
and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on AllRightTV.com.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf.